For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell in the cave. My usual partner, which is Mr. Mark Tuttle, fellow cave dweller. Mark, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, you left out something. You said I was a partner. You left out partner in crime.
Well, I almost said in crime. I want to clarify, too, because partner, unfortunately, today can mean a lot of different things.
True.
But this is the Catholic cave. So by partner, I mean in the traditional sense.
Fellow cave dweller.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
But also partner in crime, because that, to a certain extent, is what we're going to be talking about today.
It sure is.
Or at least those brave men and women who try to prevent crime.
That's right. And, responsible for all us keeping and maintaining an orderly, just, and reasonably safe society
in
which to live.
We're going to be talking a little bit about law enforcement, about police, about distinctions of what police are, what law enforcement is, what the right function and proper function of a police force is. And, it's a little bit of a hot topic these days because there's protests around the country for, alleged police brutality. Some cases it's justified, some cases it's not. So we'll talk a little bit about that. What are the boundaries of what is, I guess, justified force that the police can use? How does that differ from somebody that owns a firearm themselves and what they're allowed to do? So we're gonna go into a lot of that. These aren't legal issues. We're gonna try to dig a little bit deeper and look at some of the philosophical and ethical issues.
Yeah, some of the principles that ought to inform and shape how we then move from principles into actual policies and practices, right? So here in the Catholic Cave, we try to get at kind of the foundations of things, right? Kind of go deep.
The arche, the first principles.
There we go.
Right.
Prima facie.
Yeah. Arche sounds like the arch villain in some video game.
It also just sounds like arcade, where we used to go to play video games.
Right. That's exactly.
How,
yeah.
That's how old. That's how old I am. I remember petitioning my parents often for $5 and to take my older brother, who's a year older, Patrick, and we would go to, it was called Pin Pan Alley, and Pin Pan Alley was stuffed with the best video games, including like Tetris, Galactica, Pac-Man, and then not long after, Mrs. Pac-Man, which I refused to play because I had gender issues back then.
See, I came.
I couldn't play. I thought it was a girls' game.
See,
and
I came.
So I refused,
yeah.
As a 12-year-old, I refused to play girls' games.
See, I came around just a few years after you, and so the games had already developed quite a bit. So we were playing games like Cyber Bowl and.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
That's advanced.
I remember the big advance was the video game Dragon's Lair.
Oh,
so,
wow.
They had full video. It looked like you were watching a movie. You had limited control over your character. It's not like the video games today where you've got absolute control and it still looks like a movie. But
it's amazing.
Yeah.
Like Halo and some of these other ones that you play.
I remember Dragon's Lair and just, you would sit and watch people play it because it was like watching a movie.
Well, we were really blessed because my dad worked for Sears really his whole adult life. And we were the first house on the block, if you will, out of our circle of friends to get the very first Atari at home, and we played Pong. you really listening to this, if you don't know what Pong is, you'd have to look it up because it's so basic. It literally had like a little white, it was black and white, and the background was black, and then you had these each player had a little bar, white bar, literally rectangle, that your controller just simply went straight up and down, And then there was a little white ball that bounced around, and you just tried to not let it get past your little stick thing. I mean, and we loved it. We played it for hours and hours and hours.
Hours and hours, yeah. That's the amazing thing is you think back and go, how on earth do we entertain ourselves for hours doing something
like
that?
It'd be like giving today's equivalent would be like, imagine giving like an 11-year-old boy or girl a box of toothpicks and say, okay, entertain yourself for 3 hours with it. They just like, no way, I can't do anything with these stupid toothpicks. It's too simplistic, right, for their taste. So the reason, you know, one of the reasons why I bring this up is that it's not directly related to our topic today per se, but we do, can be a bit of a preview because Mark, you and I want to do an upcoming show on games, gaming, game theory.
Exactly.
And so that'll give us a chance to rehearse and revisit our childhoods once again at that point in some depth and update it to what's going on now. But let's get back to our topic at hand. We want to talk about law enforcement. I guess for me, Mark, as an intro into the topic or pre-work maybe a little bit to think about, we want to go back to probably Aristotle and his book on the polis, on the city-state. And part of the city-state is required justice, right, is the dominant virtue, but also order, right? Order, the tranquility of order that needs to be brought about. And whether we look at Aristotle or, you know, his teacher Plato and his seminal work, The Republic, there's in the city state, you seem to always find a role for some sort of law enforcers. And that could be, in today's parlance, police or military, because the city-state needed both.
Right, right.
Both roles to be fulfilled.
And back in ancient Greece, you know, both roles were fulfilled by the army.
Right.
So you had...
Today we have a distinction, in our country at least.
Right, and in our country. And yeah, you're right. In a lot of countries today, there is not a distinction between the military and the police. You know, I think in our country, it evolved because of the way we were formed. You know, we broke off from the British Republic with a rebellion. British Republic. It was a monarchy.
Although they had a parliament, but yeah.
Anyway,
King George,
right. We broke away from King George. And we didn't have a standing army. We had militias. And so these militias, to a certain extent, took on the role of law enforcement to a great extent. You know, early on, you had the Whiskey Rebellion where President
was that
Washington.
Down on Mass Ave?
No, but you had the militias mustered to go basically take care of these rebellious farmers that were not wanting
uprisings.
To pay. Right. Well, they were not wanting to pay their taxes.
That almost always gets you in trouble.
Right. So you had that early on where the militias were used to go to try to enforce the law. And so, you know, I think that use of a citizen militia within this country evolved eventually into municipal police forces, sheriffs, you know, the traditional units of law
eventually
enforcement.
Eventually we get a marshal system.
Right.
Because the other thing with the United States is, which would have been different from Europe, certainly at the time of the founding, is, you know, we had a lot of frontier, right? We had land acquisitions that were going to be happening, Louisiana Purchase and things like that later on. So you have the dual subjects from which to bring about order. One would be settled areas and specifically settled municipalities, like you said, settled towns, cities. But then you have the move west, and as settlers move west, you've got a different kind of law enforcement issues and military issues, right?
Right.
Because we wind up having the Indian Wars and other things.
Right. And at the heart of it, you're exactly right. At the heart of the idea of law enforcement is justice. You know, the establishment of justice within the city, within the city state, you know, within the state, within the republic, whatever unit you're looking at, the idea is that law enforcement is there to enforce the laws so that we can have a just society. Now, there's two things in conflict there often. The laws and justice, because laws aren't always just. And I think that puts law enforcement a lot of times in a difficult situation.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know when we've talked about natural law before, one of the strengths of natural law theory is that it recognizes that laws made by human beings can be unjust. Why? Because human beings, we make mistakes. We're prone, you know, we have a proclivity towards sin because of our fallen natures, original sin. But we have, but natural law is a way by which we can measure human law, laws passed by human beings, and then measure whether or not it is just or unjust, whether it comports with the natural law, because it then would, the natural law comports with divine and eternal law.
Right. Now, originally, when you look at Plato's Republic, where he lays out sort of the constituent parts of a just city, now you have to keep in mind that the reason he's doing this is so that they can have something big that they can examine, so that they can look at something small called the human soul. And all of this is to try to figure out where justice resides within the human soul. But within the big city that they're creating, the law enforcement, the guardians, as Plato calls them, they're very much at the command of people above them when it comes to justice. In other words, justice, to a certain extent, is portrayed as above their pay grade.
Right.
They're there to enforce the laws,
right,
good or bad. And, I think Plato uses the analogy of a guard dog. That, you know, a guard dog is friendly and knows those people it's supposed to protect, and they're mean and vicious against the enemies of those people. But, you know, dogs, anybody that's owned a dog knows that, this isn't well thought out from the dog's perspective a lot of times.
That just reminds you of that Jim Croce song, Bad, Bad Leroy Brown, baddest man in the whole darn town, right? It makes reference to the junkyard dog. But you're absolutely right. So even predating predating law, because law, there's that ancient Greek tragedy about how ancient Greek moved to be ruled under the law versus, and we also have this from scripture, we also know that there's a time where the initial sort of state of nature was one of retribution. And retribution would be something along the lines of, Mark, you somehow wrong me or a member of my tribe or my clan or my family, and payback is me and mine slaughtering all of you and yours.
Right, right. Right. But not just sort of out of I think, malevolent hatred, but out of the, as Nietzsche put it, out of the ability to keep one's promises. In other words, civilization and civilized people are those who are able to keep their promises. And if you can't keep your promise to me, well, I'm going to make you keep your promise to me.
Right.
And that's where civilization came. The retribution that goes against somebody, not just because we don't like them, but because they had an obligation and duty that they weren't able to keep.
Right. And so with that, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave with Tim O'Donnell. That's me, Mark Tuttle. And we are looking at the philosophical principles related to law enforcement. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
It's not too early to sign up for our Catholic Radio annual dinner. This year's dinner will be on Tuesday, October 2nd, at the Northside Knights of Columbus Hall near 71st and Keystone. Archbishop Charles C. Thompson will be our guest speaker. There'll be a silent auction, a live auction, some great food, and a chance to meet the staff and board members of Catholic Radio Indy. It'll be a great evening. Tickets are $65 per person or $450 for a table of eight. You can register online now at catholicradioindy.org. There's no charge for priests or vowed religious to attend. We'd love to have a table from every parish in the area. So go ahead, ask some friends, family members, or fellow parishioners. It's a great way to introduce them to Catholic Radio Indy. You can sign up right now at catholicradioindy.org or simply by calling us at 317-870-8400. That's 317-870-8400.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we are talking about policemen. We're talking about law enforcement today, Tim. And, the men and women that train, they devote their lives, they go to the police academy, they get up every morning to put themselves in harm's way to bring about justice within, or to keep justice, to keep the peace within our communities. We were just talking about, you know, sort of the philosophical beginnings of this is, to a certain extent, society is based on the need for people to be able to keep their promises, and there has to be retribution for those who are unable to keep their promises. And this involves violence. And that's why police work is so dangerous, because just by its very nature, there's a certain violence associated with it. And usually it's violence back against the police out of a retribution that, you know, is, I guess, kind of nature that's taken a vicious turn to a certain extent, that if you're going to try to restrict my freedom, well, you know, I'm going to lash out and attack you.
Yeah. Law enforcement, certainly, entails, encounters with, truly malevolent and vicious people at times, and it's inherently dangerous and risky.
Right.
At all in one. And so I think because when one recognizes that that's part of that profession, I think that's what adds to our admiration of what these men and women do, because of that and the complexity of the work, and that need to make split second life and death decisions.
Right, because
it's an incredible responsibility.
Right, because when a policeman puts on the badge in the morning, what they're putting on is an emblem of the power of the city to enforce the laws. And you know, if you're on the wrong side of that, you're basically faced with a situation where you have the city coming after you because of bad things that you've done, and you know inherently that this involves some element of violence to apprehend you.
Right.
And so the natural instinct is to respond in kind.
Yeah, I think sometimes I've heard it described as, you know, coercive force. So the state at whatever level, whether it's, you know, the municipal, as you've been describing, or on up through federal levels, because there's federal levels of law enforcement too, like the DEA, the FBI, et cetera, that they have the power to coerce using force up to and including deadly force.
Right, right. Now, you know, we were
that's why they have guns.
We were reminiscing in the first segment. We were reminiscing about our childhoods. You know, playing video games,
yes,
playing Pong, but you know,
Asteroids. Oh my gosh, I lost so much of my childhood to playing Asteroids. So unproductive.
But see,
looking back,
we were also on the tail end, or at least I was, on the very tail end of a lot of the cops and robbers shows.
Oh, so, yes.
You know, I remember
they were super popular in the 70s.
They were super popular in the 70s, and so by the time I came of age, they were being rerun in the 80s. But
oh man, so my Beretta, Starsky and Hutch,
exactly.
Adam 12, Dragnet. I could go on and on, but I can tell I'm interrupting you.
And law enforcement, the way they were portrayed there, it was much more violent than what it actually is now. And maybe it was much more violent than what it actually was then too. But it seems like the violence over time associated with law enforcement, if you go way, way back, law enforcement was a much, much more violent business than what it is today.
Yes. And there's a few things. A lot of people don't realize, I was surprised by this, but very recently I was kind of looking into crime statistics. Part of what I, in an ethics class I teach, we will touch on like death penalty and again, some of what we're talking about here, what are prisons for, those sorts of questions. And over the last 20 years, you know, felony crimes in the U.S. has fallen nearly 50%. I mean, it's a huge, huge reduction in the worst kinds of crimes that we have. It doesn't feel that way, though, because why I was caught off guard and surprised, you might be surprised listening and hearing that, is because the news media continues to have 90% of the coverage is always on the horrible things that have happened. That's been the way my entire life watching TV news is. They always lead with all the things that are, you know, going wrong. And so you don't get, that doesn't give us a clear picture of what overall crime is it on the rise or falling?
Yeah, then that might be a topic for a show in the future. You know, some of the, just like we're talking about some of the philosophical concepts behind law enforcement, some of the philosophical concepts behind journalism and media coverage as well. But one of the things that I think feeds into that is the media cycle is now 24/7.
Right.
Yeah, it used to be you would tune in for the news in the evening, you'd read the morning paper, you would get a day's worth of news in maybe a 20 to 30 minute segment. Now you've got, CNN on constantly, Fox News on constantly.
I know someone who relies on Twitter to get all of his news.
Yeah, exactly. Twitter's the same way. You're right. I mean, and if you're
that's
getting
Mark
it via internet,
with a C.
Yeah. But still, if you you know, either way, the news cycle is 24/7, and so what was something insignificant, you know,
oh, yeah,
back in the early 1980s, is now going to be seen as highly significant.
Right. Well, and what you know, the way, as I understand, media is monetized is by viewership, right? And so, if you want, people will not turn on things that are boring, and so you've got to find, you know, ways to glamorize and make your shows, your programming attractive. But let me take us back though to something before I forget. I've been in the cave a long time, so I can be forgetful. So I want to go back to something we were talking about, kind of retribution, this initial sort of maybe state of nature, one of vengeance, of one wreaking havoc on one's adversaries by wiping them completely out.
Well,
yeah,
in an effort to establish justice.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, it was seen to be just. And so what we then moved, though, from is from that state of affairs, we can look into the Mosaic Law, you know, in the Old Testament, and we see this move towards what? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, right? Comes out of the Old Testament, the Mosaic Law. And what that does is it actually, as an expression of authentic justice, it reduces the overall violence, because now to get even with how you've harmed or wronged me, Mark, instead of me wiping out you and your entire clan or tribe or family, it's you alone or the guilty alone that must face justice. So it's an elevation of justice that brings about less violence.
Right, because if you go back to Nietzsche's description of the state of nature, where, you know, civilization comes about because suddenly people now are forced to keep their promises, that force is not commensurate with the offense. In other words, if I break a promise to you, you're right, the ability to keep, you know, to enforce that is somebody coming and wiping out my entire family, my entire clan, etc., to scare me into keeping my promises.
Right.
But when you move to the Bible, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, now what you're talking about is justice that is commensurate with the crime.
Proportional,
exactly. So
individual.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
So that's a huge leap forward. But that's still, though, it's also leading us towards the great insight that the Greeks had, which was to live under laws rather than simply what we would call a kind of vigilantism, where we take the law into our own hands. So in other words, we as a community, as a society, enact these codes, these ordinances of reason that we agree to live by and under, versus, again, kind of going back to the original sort of state of nature, which was I simply, if I felt I was being wronged, it was up to me, one, to make that determination, and two, you know, it kind of became, you know, sheriff, jury, judge, executioner, all in one. And it's this move towards our societies being governed by, agreeing to be governed by laws rather than the dictates of individual conscience, per se, and visiting the violence upon each other, that's where you have the foundations of what we have today is in terms of the modern state.
Yeah, and you bring up a very important distinction there, Tim. When you're talking about a system where it's upon me to establish justice, it's upon me to protect my own property, to make sure that other people are keeping their promises that they've promised me, you're talking about a system that... Very uneven.
Exactly. Yeah, because right. let's say I steal something from you, something valuable from you. If it's up to you to get it back, you know, you're how you're going to go about it, and how angry you are about, you know, what you think is fair and just. It could be totally different than Jim Ganley. If I stole something from Jim Ganley, the exact same item, he might react very differently. And so there's the unevenness.
The unevenness. And part of the idea behind...
You might execute me, Mark.
Right? Yeah.
Jim might just... He's a nice guy. He might just, you know, take it back and scold me.
Right.
Well, you're going to pluck my eyes out.
Well, you know, here's the deal, too. If I'm too brutal with you, then Jim may turn around and be too brutal with me.
Oh,
so,
that's
true,
too.
There's an escalation.
A cycle. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, and we can, you know, we've done shows on Rene Girard. You know, Rene Girard thinks that this cycle...
I knew you were going to bring him up. Yeah. I was going to bet on it. And I'm glad you did. I love Rene Girard, too.
But, you know, this escalating violence... you know, it's more than just the individual violence of the Nietzsche describes. Rene Girard sees that as, you know, that escalates beyond just the individual level to being a societal wide crisis that has to be mitigated somehow.
And that's through the scapegoating
mechanism.
And that's
through religion, exactly. But we're talking about law enforcement today. And law enforcement's a step, one huge step in advance, I guess, of this individual justice. Because now the police force isn't representing my interests against your interests. It's basically our common interests that are represented and defended
by
law enforcement.
Yeah, that's a common that move towards from unevenness across the, you know, individual vigilantes doling out justice to this common a set of common understandings. I mean, laws too, it might be helpful to point out that, you know, under natural law theory, and as I understand St. Thomas Aquinas to teach, it really has kind of four components for a law. And one is that it's an ordinance of reason. Another is that it's promulgated so that people, you can't have secret laws and hold people accountable to it. They have to be promulgated. They have to be legislated by a due authority, and then they have to be enforceable. You have to be able to, you can't pass laws that are unenforceable. So for example, you wouldn't, you may, I think this is what, I think this would be, unachievable, but we know that pornography is evil, and it does tremendous harm to the human person and human relationships. And so, but passing a law that says that would say, you know, no one, all pornography is outlawed with a zero tolerance policy is unenforceable because of the the amount of force, state force, and people that you need to be involved
exactly.
to carry that out. We would have to give up. We would have to erect a enormous branch of law enforcement to try to carry it out, and it would be really unenforceable. So, with that, let's take a quick pause. We're listening to Catholic Cave with Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell here on Catholic Radio Indy. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
And that's what we're all about right here on Catholic Radio Indy, spreading the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Hi, I'm Kent Blanford. Join me every Saturday and Sunday morning at 10 for Catholic Jukebox Indiana, an hour of contemporary music with a Catholic message. That's Catholic Jukebox Indiana, Saturday and Sunday at 10 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we are talking about justice, laws, justice,
crime and punishment.
Exactly. Actually, we're talking about law enforcement specifically, and we were just talking about what the advance of law is in terms of justice. That, you know, justice initially started off as something that was really probably on the back of the individual to enforce justice, and it was usually probably not justly enforced. So it was usually some form of retribution for a harm that somebody's done, or some way of trying to enforce a person's promises that they made. But then there was an advance where we had proportional justice expressed through the New Testament, where it wasn't just me going and trying to force you to stand by what you've said, but suddenly there was a proportionality to it where it was only just for an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth.
Yeah, I think in the Old Testament.
In the Old Testament.
Yeah, Mosaic law.
And then you mentioned the movement towards law in the Greek sense, a universal law, a law code that's promulgated for the common good, that's accessible to all, it's understood by all, but it has to be enforced. And so it has to be enforceable, but
you have to carry it out, right?
But then, the terms of justice change a little bit from a law enforcement that is there concentrated on justice. Now, law enforcement is focused on the law, which presumably is an expression of justice, but not always. Sometimes things go wrong.
Correct, and this is, I think, a preeminent example of from relatively current history in our country would be Jim Crow laws in the South prior to the civil rights movement, and where you had law enforcement carrying out segregation, for example. We know segregation, looking back, we know that it was wrong and ought not to have been in place. But as a member of law enforcement, you're there to carry out the laws on the books. You're not there. You're not a legislator, and you're not a judge. And so therein lies a real societal problem, because when you have unjust laws. And here, letter from Birmingham Jail, which I bring up all the time because it's one of the preeminent American writings. And in it, Dr. Martin Luther King points out several times the great harm that these unjust laws inflict on people, because they are universal in the sense that they hold sway over, say, an entire state of Alabama or Arkansas or something like that. Everyone of goodwill or ill will is subject to the unjust law, and therefore the amount of harm that it causes is grave. Because you have those who are the target of the unjust law, but you also have people of goodwill who are now coerced into enforcing it or playing along with it or going along with it.
Right, and
so that's what really magnifies it.
Right, it magnifies it, and it does harm to the soul of those that are basically given the duty of enforcing the law.
Correct.
So you're causing people to have to go against their conscience. You know, that police officer, you know, I don't know what his individual soul or what he thought about race relations or whatever, but that police officer that had to go in and arrest Rosa Parks, you know, presumably this was doing damage to his soul by forcing him to do that. But he also really didn't exactly have the right to say no.
To refuse. Yeah, it brings up, you know, a different kind of topic, which is, you know, we have to think it through again, degrees of separation of evil and our participation in evil, and when can we refuse, and when is it are we far enough removed that we and based on our circumstances that it's okay to continue with, because it's our occupation to continue with it. The classic example is the postal carrier, who is, as part of his or her job, it comes to realize that, hey, as I'm delivering the mail, I'm delivering things I find morally, deeply morally objectionable, like I'm delivering
drugs,
porno magazines,
or, right, exactly,
you know, or other things, contraceptions or contraception or something like that, something deeply morally objectionable. Can I just refuse not to deliver, leave those in the truck? No, you but we'd have to sort that out a little bit. But getting back to the law enforcement piece, that is, we recognize that law comes with a kind of approval, meaning that it instills a kind of approval that, in other words, especially as you talk to young people who haven't worked out yet kind of how to make determination standards of just and unjust law. They just, if it's lawful, we assume it's good, right? Because why would we have laws that aren't pointed towards the common good?
Right.
And so therefore it's attractive. It has the force of attraction and therefore teaches.
Exactly. Law has the force of a teacher of morality.
Right.
Law is supposed to express what's right and wrong. So therefore, to a certain extent, it teaches what's right and wrong.
That's why we don't want to legalize things that are bad.
Right.
Like drugs.
Right. But I think you had brought up, and I think this is an important thing, it has to be enforceable in a humane way. And I think that's
St. Augustine, I'm borrowing from Augustine.
Right, exactly. But, I think when you're talking about drugs, I think that's where the debate often resides. It's not so much whether drugs are harmful or not, although some people will argue that they're not harmful, but it's how burdensome is the enforcement, how much violence is the enforcement of the drug trade causing. Those types of things are what get bandied about and argued.
Yeah, I mean, there's a and there was a homily that was shared recently, and one of the things I liked about the homily was the priest makes a distinction between there are good people out there that simply have weaknesses. I'm one of them, right? And we're struggling against our weaknesses, right? We're all sinners. We're called to something higher. And we receive God's grace and we're trying to cooperate with it. That's one set of circumstances. It's a completely different kind of person who, one person who's struggling with, say, substance abuse problem and doing their best to address it and contend with it, as compared to the drug dealer who's vicious and malevolent, who's in it. That's a different kind of, that's someone who's embracing the evil.
Exactly.
And personifying it and extending the evil and misery that comes along with drug addiction.
Yeah.
Those are two totally different, that is truly a bad person.
Right.
That's why they called that show Breaking Bad, because he was breaking his soul up, I would say, into a very bad person.
Right. And, Aristotle makes the distinction between somebody that is intemperate. They've got a weakness of will. Know what's right and wrong. They know what the right is, but their will's just too weak to be able
Saint
to follow.
St. Paul writes eloquently about that.
Exactly. And then...
And who doesn't experience that, right?
Right. But then there's
also... I think of the Big Mac, okay? I'm not supposed to have a Mark, but once in a while... I can't help myself.
Exactly.
I see. I mean, I could help myself, but I don't.
And once,
on purpose, I
right,
give in.
And once upon a time, you were able to help. You were able to keep yourself. But now
correct.
That you've given in several
it's
times.
It's harder and harder.
You can't even drive by
they're
a
so
McDonald's
delicious.
Without stopping.
Right. Well, that's not actually true yet. Don't wish that upon me.
But that's different than somebody that has absolutely no idea that the cheeseburgers are harmful for you.
Right.
That just
right,
sees
right.
absolutely nothing wrong with eating cheeseburgers because they don't know anything about nutrition or how bad the cheeseburger can be for you.
That's right.
That's a different type of.
That's making me
evil.
Hungry. We better move the conversation forward.
Well, moving the conversation forward, we were talking about how law is a great teacher, and that leads into probably the second, I would say, place where law enforcement can often go wrong. And that is somebody that is tasked with enforcing the law is by nature, to a certain extent, a little bit above the law. So if they're the ones enforcing it, they can decide whether or not it ought to be enforced against them.
Well, that's an excellent point. That's a great insight, Mark. They, right. Well, they're in a position because the authority granted them the role that they have, to exempt themselves in a way. In a way that others are not, right? They can, and we see that all the time. It's depicted in television shows and crime shows. The cop gone bad, that kind of thing, where someone's abusing their power, their authority to and position to advantage themselves, break commitments and vows and promises. And harm others.
Yeah. And that's there's two sides to that coin, because on the one hand, you've got great temptations, I think, for law enforcement. You've also got a tendency for law enforcement to just simply enforce laws that may be bad. So you take both of those. You've got the fact that laws aren't always going to be perfect, and law enforcement's tasked with enforcing sometimes bad laws. And law enforcement has to be a little bit of a check on that. Law enforcement can stand in the way of bad laws being enforced. They can take a stand. So you've got that side of it. Plus, you've got the other side of it, that they're in a little bit of a position to where they can abuse their power.
You see it all the time. And, outside of the United States, even more so, where in some more developing countries where it's, you know, bribery. Bribing, you know, state officials, including the police, is demanded, I had some friends who recently went through a whole adoption process in China, and now maybe bribery is probably might be a little bit too strong, but there were definitely payments and gifts
exactly
along the way. Bribery would be an ugly word, or corruption.
Right.
But they're bribery. But at least, you know, when I go to, say, if I have to go to the Fishers Police Department where I live, they're not expecting me to show up with
tips.
Gift cards and to get them to, you know, hear me out. You know, yep. Hey, someone stole my lawnmower. You know, here's a gift.
Right.
You know, but it does operate very differently. And I think when I have met through the Acton Institute, met a lot of really great people from different countries in Africa, that corruption at the state level is one of the huge barriers. The theme you keep bringing up, Mark, that's so insightful too, around the we have to keep our promises, and if we don't keep our promises in a fashion that includes a kind of equality, right, across, say, the performance of contracts, then when bribery and corruption enter in, those are huge impediments to development. Because at the end of the day, most of what we do and rely upon, I would say, it's still a matter of a handshake. It's still people we generally trust, generally tend to trust each other. We generally tend to take each other at our words. We don't demand, you know, written, you know, affidavits as to, oh, well, how was your day? What'd you do today? Well, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to need that in writing with three witnesses.
Right.
No, you know, it's just but that's where law and law enforcement can play such a decisive role in the broader society, that if law enforcement is compromised to any great extent, then society it makes the society sick.
Right. And there's two sides of that coin, because we have to hold our law enforcement that are good up, you know, basically in the highest esteem, because a good moral law enforcement agent basically has to exemplify that moral caliber every day. I mean, they're in a situation where
the role modeling is key.
Role modeling is key, and we demand it of them, and rightly so. Society ought to demand the highest moral caliber from its police officers. Well, we are coming up on another break, and so when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about law enforcement and the role in society that the law enforcement plays.
It's not too early to sign up for our Catholic Radio annual dinner. This year's dinner will be on Tuesday, October 2nd at the Northside Knights of Columbus Hall near 71st and Keystone. Archbishop Charles Thompson will be our guest speaker. There'll be a silent auction, a live auction, some great food, and a chance to meet the staff and board members of Catholic Radio Indy. You can sign up right now at catholicradioindy.org or by giving us a call at 317-870-8400. Just a reminder that Catholic Radio is listener-supported. If you haven't joined our family of donors yet, you can do so online at catholicradioindy.org.
Welcome back once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell. We are continuing our discussion of law enforcement and some of the first principles behind law enforcement. And we talked about how justice is kind of the underlying principle there for, you know, what law enforcement's about, how the idea of a police force is a development beyond just justice being something, you know, between you and me. I have to somehow force you to keep your promises, Tim.
You're a wise man, because I could be slippery.
And before the break, we were talking about how, to a certain extent, the nature of law enforcement requires a higher moral caliber from the law enforcement agents. That just the nature of having to be able to evaluate the law and determine whether the law truly is just or not before you enforce it, and really being kind of that last last sort of watchdog before unjust laws can wreak havoc on an entire society. Law enforcement also has to be above the ability to be corrupt, because power will ultimately lead, to a certain extent, towards a temptation, at least, for corruption. So law enforcement
agents, hierarchies in general lean towards tyranny.
Right. And, you know, we've talked on the show about the importance and loss of a liberal arts education. And I think this is one of those examples where that liberal arts education as a foundational principle from which education then can go in a vocational direction is crucial. You know, our law enforcement
totally
agents need to be able to have a sense of justice. They need to have a sense of the good. They need to have a sense of the true in order to do their jobs as effective law enforcement agents.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right with that. And, you know, something, you know, Adler and his project team pointed out in their book, The Great Conversation, is that we need to ascend from, we acquire sort of knowledge, right, about what things are. And then we move into understanding kind of why, the why behind these things, the hows. And you get to begin to then, across these different disciplines, you engage in a synthesis of this knowledge, and you begin to see the interrelationship and interplay between these great ideas. And that's the foundation, I think, that you and I both would say is critical, or at least optimizes then the layering on of vocational specialization. So it's from that platform, because now you really understand things like the human person and why human beings are valuable. I mean, what you don't want to do is you don't want to have a police force or elements of any sort of law enforcement operating under bad anthropology, that think that, you know, if you think human beings are generally worthless and easily replaceable and subordinated to the broader project of the state, you're going to get a kind of brutality within their mindset, and then that's going to affect how they carry out their mission. And when that's in play, you see that institutionalized by the term, when you hear the term police state, that's pointing towards an institutionalized misanthropological conceptual framework than I would say sort of instilled in a body of laws that then their police force then carries out.
Yeah, and once again, this is a two-sided coin, because, you know, not only do you see, I think, the general understanding of these great ideas within a police force. And, you know, you can see how the police force treats its people as sort of emblematic of what the society as a whole thinks of people. I think you're exactly right about that. The opposite is true as well. You know, how society reacts to a police force, I think, is emblematic. So to a certain extent, you know, relations with the police within a given community, I think, are kind of a canary in the coal mine as far as the philosophical state of health of that community.
Yeah, I remember reading Gulag Archipelago by Solzhenitsyn, and one of the things, or very early on, that he points out as one of the tactics of the Soviet Union police state is that they would always do their arrests in the middle of the night, and because it's terrifying. not only on you, if you're the subject of the arrest, because they're going to kick down your door and literally steal you away out of your bed in front of your family. But it had the double effect on purpose of terrorizing all your neighbors and anyone that saw them doing it to you. Because the last thing, because if you weren't arrested, the very first thing you'd say is, thank God it wasn't me. I hope it never is me, right?
Right.
And so it creates this... again, it creates a kind of a coercion through terror, because you don't want to be renditioned in the middle of the night off to a gulag. And so you're going to, so when you get up in the morning after watching your neighbor being taken away in such harsh fashion, you're going to play along. You're much more likely to play along with the Soviet schemes than you were having not witnessed something like that. You're much more inclined, and that's they're trying to break your will.
Right. And also, you know, if you're in a African country, we talked about this, or a banana republic, Central South American banana republic, where the police forces are incredibly corrupt.
Yeah, Venezuela right now.
You have no respect for the law enforcement, and therefore you have less respect for the law in general.
Correct.
The law appears to be arbitrary. The law appears to be randomly enforced. All you see is the brutality of the police. And so your natural reaction as a citizen there is to demean the idea of law, to demean the idea of order, and to see society as pretty much every man for himself.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, like I said, the relationship between law enforcement and the general public is very much a canary in the coal mine, which, you know, I think when we're looking at, you know, current situation of the United States, we're seeing this breakdown in a lot of communities of the relations between the police and the general public.
Right. And that's precipitated by both real and, I would say, somewhat perhaps manufactured wrongdoings on the part of law enforcement.
And magnified by the media. You know, we talked about the role that the media plays in this. That, you know, the 24-hour news cycle is going to tend to amplify just about anything going on.
Yeah, and I think you really put your finger on something important, Mark, when you point to the subversion of the law by either the variety of ways it happens, bad actors within law enforcement giving scandal, one. Another is just the lack or uneven enforcement of crucial laws is another. And so as we, you know, as laws are ignored or not enforced, then it undermines one's belief in and desire to follow other laws. It's like, well, if we're not going to follow this law, well, why should we follow the other? You know, one of the examples, you know, that I'm watching closely is the state of Colorado, because in the state of Colorado, the state has legalized, you know, the commercial and recreational use of marijuana, but it's still criminalized at the federal level. So at some point, I'm observing this. One, I'm interested to see how that choice by the citizens of at least the majority of citizens in Colorado plays out. But I'm also interested in how it's going to be reconciled, the federal with the state laws, because the statutes are in complete opposition.
Right. And there's conflict there, not only between, you know, federal law enforcement and the citizens of Colorado, but there's also conflict between varying levels of law enforcement as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the sharper issues that jumped out really is around banking. Right. Banking is generally governed. There's a lot of federal laws that govern banking. And so their activity at the federal level of this commercial marijuana society is one in which, you know, they can't really make use of the banking system.
Right.
So that's created stories of, I've not confirmed this, I've not seen it myself, but stories of, you know, large amounts of cash, you know, just being like out in the shed and stuff. Yeah. I mean, just crazy stuff going on. But hey, we're going to run out of time. We only got a couple of minutes left here, Mark. You know, I thought this was really been a helpful conversation talking about law enforcement. But again, kind of from a philosophical Catholic perspective, it getting at some of these underlying principles.
Right.
What are some of your final thoughts?
Well, first off, you know, I think we have to recognize that law enforcement is a huge step of progress, I guess, and continuing progress in terms of justice within a society. I also think that the law enforcement and the relations between law enforcement and the public, how we view law enforcement, is a good indicator of the philosophical health of a society. When you've got stories of Officer McClarty that's running around, you know, talking to the boys about how they ought to conduct themselves when mom and dad aren't around, you know, when you've got a society that the stories of the police are like that, as opposed to the stories of the police being some of the horrors that you hear out of South Africa during apartheid, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You've got a good idea of the philosophical health of those two societies.
Well, you know, before we go, one of the things I want to make sure that we do is express our gratitude for everyone who's in law enforcement. It's an incredibly dangerous and risky job. These men and women put their lives at risk every single day and in a moment's notice. And that's everyone from the street cops that we all see from time to time, and all the way up through those engaged at the highest level law enforcement, the FBI. You have our gratitude and our admiration for everything that you're doing.
Right. And not only for putting yourself in line, but also for showing that moral character that we talked about before. It takes a higher grade of, I think, moral clarity and moral discernment to do a good job as a law enforcement agent.
Yep. And with that, you know what? We're going to wrap it up here for this episode of The Catholic Cave. But stay tuned, because we are going to continue with Catholic Radio Indy programming. And also, tune in again next week to The Catholic Cave, because we've got some more great programs coming up. Mark and I have been working on additional new topics, and we're looking forward to bringing those topics to you on our next episode.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.